Have you ever thought about what happens when you take a pill? You place it on your tongue, take a sip of water, and swallow. The pill travels down your esophagus into your stomach, and then later enters your intestines. But the pill's journey doesn't stop here. The active ingredient needs to find its way to the target delivery location. And in order to do so, the pill needs to dissolve. And the active ingredient needs to be absorbed into the bloodstream. With all of this physiology running in the background, researchers developing formulations of orally administered therapies must consider a vast array of processes and conditions to ensure that these medicines have a good bioavailability. They see how they are absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and excreted from the body. But testing each and every formulation on real patients would be tricky, as it would require a huge amount of product, time, and personnel. Thankfully, scientists can use mathematical models to model these processes. These models, called physiologically based pharmacokinetic models, or PBPK, are used to describe and predict a drug's bioavailability based on a set of physiological parameters.
This type of modeling software, it's really powerful because it's able to combine factors such as gastrointestinal physiology, population characteristics.
We just heard from Diana Mudi, a senior principal engineer working in R&D here at Lonza. She will be joined today by John DiBella, a president of the PBPK and Chem Informatics at Simulations Plus. He will speak about how these mathematical models can be used to predict the behavior of drugs in our bodies. But even more than that,
what we need to do is think about how is it we can communicate the models that we're developing in a simplified way and give the physicians a very easy to use interface where they would just be able to go in again for certain medicines and type in a basic set of information about a patient and get back out relatively quickly what is the prescribed dose level for that individual.
It might sound pretty futuristic, but PBPK modeling is taking us much closer to this setup than you might think. I am Martina Hestericová, your host of A View On, a podcast brought to you by Lonza. On this podcast, we have discussed many therapeutic modalities so far, but the majority of them are administered intravenously. But today, we are going to focus on oral administration. Diana, could you summarize for us what are the benefits of this administration route compared to others?
Sure. So the oral route is actually one of the most convenient routes of administration since the patients can self-administer the medication at home simply by swallowing it. And since it doesn't require any special equipment or visiting a hospital or clinic, it really minimizes costs as well. And for these reasons, it's really one of the most popular means of administering medicines.
Now, if I think about oral administration and the route this drug dosage form needs to go through, right? It has to go through the mouth, get into the stomach, then into the digestive system, then dissolve and be absorbed, right, by our intestinal tract and get into the bloodstream. I'd like to discuss the bioavailability, right? So how much of the active ingredient is actually getting into our system. I wonder, what are the mechanisms by which drugs can enter the bloodstream? And how can formulation scientists such as yourself influence the bioavailability of these therapies?
Yeah, you're right. Orally administered drugs must dissolve in gastrointestinal fluids once they're swallowed. And then once they're in solution, they actually have to permeate through the intestinal wall. So those are two key barriers for absorption that really can potentially limit the bioavailability, especially for many of the poorly soluble drugs that we work with. Once they get into the intestinal wall, there's still some additional barriers to absorption, such as being metabolized in the gut wall or also metabolized upon first pass through the liver. So we can actually influence some of these processes and, in a sense, enhance that bioavailability by formulating these drugs a certain way. In order to do that effectively, we first have to understand the properties of the drug. So those molecular properties that actually influence the dissolution, permeation, and metabolism. And once we understand those properties, then we can determine which types of dosage forms might be best. And when we're doing that, we're not only doing testing in the lab, but we're also utilizing in silico tools such as physiologically based pharmacokinetic modeling software.
Right, thank you. It's really interesting because just recently on an episode with Vincent Janin, we were discussing about how we can influence the delivery of the cargo by changing the composition of a capsule in case of a capsule delivery. And it's really interesting to see that this can be also influenced by formulation. And on the first season of the podcast, we also spoke about the formulation development of intravenously administered drugs, where you can add in an ingredient that can interact with the protein that's in the formulation and improve its stability or decrease absorption, etc. I wonder, from the perspective of a small molecules formulation scientist, how are you actually changing the formulation there? Is this the granularity of the powder? Is this also some excipients or other ingredients that you're adding to the mix?
Great question. So one of the challenges I discussed was the inability for drugs to dissolve and stay dissolved in gastrointestinal fluids. For many of those drugs, improving the solubility through formulation is a great strategy. We have a number of ways of doing that. One is we can actually change the structure of the crystal itself. We can combine the API with additional excipients that can actually boost that solubility. We can also convert the crystalline form into the amorphous form, which is actually a higher energy form that's more readily able to dissolve in gastrointestinal fluids. And there are also some formulation strategies for increasing permeability, such as adding permeation enhancers to the formulation, maybe formulating the drug as nanoparticles.
You mentioned the physiologically based pharmacokinetic modeling. Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
This type of modeling software, it's really powerful because it's able to combine factors such as gastrointestinal physiology, population characteristics, so differences in those physiologies between, say, adults and children. It also combines drug and formulation properties in order to mathematically describe a drug's movement through the body. So it can actually simulate some of those processes I was talking about, like dissolution and permeation. And then we can use that to predict what the ranges in those variables might do to the overall absorption process. So really, it's a way to just assemble all of the information that we've collected about the drug through prediction and through in vitro testing.
Okay, thank you. Now, John, how does Simulations Plus come into play here?
Well, Deanna did a fantastic job of describing the modeling methodologies that can be applied to help drive formulation design and evaluation forward. Simulations Plus, it has been now, and I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, 30 plus years since our founder of the company had the vision to say, hey, a lot of other industries are utilizing modeling and simulation to help support their research and development efforts, whether it was aerospace, whether it was automotive, and so on. Why aren't the pharmaceutical and biotech industries doing the same thing? And so we've been devoted now for 30 years to the development and advancement of modeling and simulation science, really supporting pharmaceutical and biotech research from the earliest stages of discovery going all the way through to post-approval. And our livelihood is based upon the use of different in silico technologies, whether it's machine learning, whether it's more advanced bottom-up approaches like systems pharmacology models, or what is one of our bread and butter areas, the physiologically based pharmacokinetic approaches, really just trying to provide the best combination of software and expert guidance and support services and solutions to help advance the R&D efforts forward.
So what you've just described focuses on pharmacokinetics. Can your software also be used to model what happens once the drug metabolizes? I mean, what's the toxicology of its intermediates and so on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So what we can also do is, as we're modeling the API, the parent drug's dissolution and absorption, if it is in fact interacting with any enzymes, whether it's in the GI tract, whether it's in the liver, whether it's in any other tissue or organ around the body, we can then start to predict what are those likely metabolites or intermediaries that are going to be formed. And we have the opportunity from there to predict not only what their exposure would look like as they distribute all around the body, but we could also predict whether or not they're likely to cause any toxic side effects or adverse outcomes.
Out of curiosity, can you tell us about what kind of software you're using to make all of these predictions?
We have tools, again, spanning from discovery going all the way through post-approval, where our partnership is closest with Deanna and her team at Lonza is with one of our flagship tools, which is called GastroPlus. And this program is where we're able to essentially set up a virtual animal or human model. And as Deanna so elegantly described a little bit earlier when talking about PBPK, what we're able to do here is represent animals or humans as a collection of organs and tissues that are each going to be defined by a system of mathematical equations. And what we're going to do is we're going to scour the literature. We are going to gather data that is provided to us by collaboration partners in academia, industry, regulatory bodies, and use quantitative values, parameters, and also equations that are going to describe certain characteristics like body weights and blood flow rates and so on, and also mechanisms like dissolution and precipitation, absorption and metabolism, and be able to then simulate and predict what is going to be that local exposure of drug at the site of administration. So for example, the orally delivered products, what are the concentrations dissolved and undissolved within the GI tract, and then systemically. So as things then become bioavailable and enter into the bloodstream, what are the concentrations going to look like all around the body? And so we can do this for animals and we can do this for humans. And once we have a good animal model in place, we can then start to extrapolate from one species into another and eventually into humans to do the first in human assessments.
And I have to ask, what kind of animals are you modeling?
That's a really good question, and it's one that's coming up from a lot of different angles, to be frank. So we started with, again, a primary focus on pharmaceutical and biotech research. And so in the beginning, it was focused on laboratory animals. What are those species that are commonly tested during the course of developing a drug? So mice, rats, different variations of monkeys, dogs, as we've expanded into simulating for non-oral delivery routes, like dermal, for example. We've built in mini pig models. For ocular delivery, we've built in rabbit models. But we've also started to see increased interest in the approaches from animal health or veterinary medicine groups as well. And so we do have a couple of active partnerships where we are developing these same kind of virtual animal models for household pets like cats, guinea pigs, and also for farm animals like cattle, for example, and chickens. So that is a next frontier. We're just in the relatively early stages of research for some of those. But we have very, very well-defined models already in place for all of the common animal species that would be utilized during the course of an R&D project in the pharma biotech spaces.
Curious. These are all mammals, right? Is this more about the size of the animal and the weight of the animal, or are there other processes in place that really differentiate the animals from one another and humans from them as well?
When you're going from a lab animal to a farm animal, there are definitely going to be some pretty significant underlying differences in the physiology. So something like cattle, for example, have multiple stomachs. And so we would have to modify the architecture of the GI tract model that we have. As you mentioned, you know, there are certain animals that have been identified through, again, decades of research and being somewhat predictive of what will ultimately be occurring when we get to clinical trials in humans. And so that's where rats to monkeys to dogs is the typical track that is followed, because with varying degrees of success, there has been shown the ability to scale, not in this case by the differences in body sizes, in blood flow rates, in the differences in expression levels of enzymes and transporters. Going from something like cattle to humans, that would be a big leap. But if we stay within the guardrails and boundaries that have been outlined through, again, lots and lots of research, you know, there's a pretty good path forward going from the smaller species up to humans.
Thank you for that. I think you just touched a really interesting area, physiology, and how it can even differ from one human to another, especially if we also consider all the diseases, right? Is this also something you can simulate? Changes in the respective biochemistry for the respective disease profiles? Or am I pushing this a little bit too much?
No. It's absolutely within the realm of what we can do. Actually, we had a little chat before the podcast started, giving folks who are listening a little bit of the behind the scenes here of what we ate for breakfast, respectively. And so as an example, an answer to your question, you know, we could go in and we could say, okay, if I am a 20-something female who has had oatmeal or yogurt for breakfast, I can set that simulation scenario up and do some predictions for how a certain drug or formulation is going to behave versus a 44-year-old male like myself who is has eaten a Granny Smith apple and will soon have a bowl of Raisin Bran cereal. We can get that granular with the scenarios that we want to predict, not only seeing the differences between you, Deanna, and I in terms of the sizes of our tissues, the blood flow rates, the expression levels of the enzymes or transporters, but then also, you know, what is it that I've eaten so far today? What sort of caloric intake have I had? What sort of fat content is in the meal that I've consumed? And how does that impact then the GI physiology, which will then impact potentially how the formulation is going to disintegrate, how the API material is going to dissolve and ultimately be absorbed? All of that information, this very, very vast physiological database, is all part of the technology that we develop and allows our users to then be able to simulate for all of these different scenarios.
Sounds pretty futuristic to me. Sounds like we are aiming towards a personalized medicine approach, right? Is this something you see in the future? And this question is also extended to you, Deanna.
Yeah, I'll start. And then Deanna, please comment. I teed it up for you. Absolutely. This is something that I wouldn't even say is so much futuristic. I mean, it's really starting to be incredible to see the different data sets that are being collected. And how is it that we can understand really through relatively simple tests, whether or not I have certain elevation of enzyme levels or expression levels of different metabolic pathways or transporter pathways, we could build that information up. And you can go into software today and say, listen, I want to create a 44-year-old healthy American male that is 5'11" and weighs 82 kilos and also has this expression of certain enzymes. And if we have a well-validated drug model for a certain medicine, we can then do some reverse dosimetry potentially and say, okay, for this particular individual subject that is going to be prescribed this medicine, what dose level do they need to have in order to be within a certain therapeutic target window or in order to have the therapeutic outcome that we're hoping for? Deanna is an expert in the application of PBPK models. The physicians aren't. What we need to do is think about how is it we can communicate the models that we're developing in a simplified way and give the physicians or ultimately at some point the pharmacists, you know, a very easy to use interface, so to speak, where they would just be able to go in again for certain medicines and type in a basic set of information about a patient and get back out relatively quickly what is the prescribed dose level for that individual.
Thank you. Now, if I am to bring this back to the pharmaceutical manufacturing DNA, are these simulations performed once a drug is already in the drug product manufacturing stage, or is this better performed earlier while we are still in the drug substance stage?
Yeah, so I think the answer is all of the above. We can use this throughout the stages of drug development. So when we're in the API stage, we're able to actually use some software provided by Simulations Plus called ADMET Predictor to predict many properties of that API that can dictate some of the things we've been talking about, such as, say, solubility and permeability. And then we can actually tune that structure or choose a different structural analog of the drug to pick one that, first and foremost, is going to be safe and efficacious, but secondly, has the properties it needs to make it into the bloodstream using an oral route, if that's what we're interested in. And then once we're set, let's say on an API, and we bring it into the formulation stage, then we're using the tool to make forward-looking predictions going into even the first animal study. So we're using it to rank order those formulations. So we might have five formulations we're testing in the lab. They might all be pretty similar in terms of stability, manufacturability. They might all look pretty good in our dissolution test, but then we can put that data into the simulation software and really help differentiate, you know, which ones do we want to take into the clinic. And that can be super helpful because it can decrease the amount of formulations we're taking into the clinic, which can decrease the burden on animals. So, you know, we're trying to reduce the animal testing that we're doing. And then it also decreased costs for drug developers and increased timelines. Then we're continuing to use the software to do things like set drug product specifications together with the regulatory agencies, such as the FDA, to say, okay, how do I ensure that the properties of this drug product are going to maintain consistent throughout drug product manufacturing? So I really advocate its use kind of from start to finish.
Yeah, and if I can just piggyback on that last part, Deanna did a fantastic job of describing it from discovery through approval. That part about the drug product specifications is becoming a very, very hot area right now, not only to ensure the consistency in the products, and as Deanna mentioned, making sure that they are safe and effective as you scale up production, but even post-approval, if you know the company is, for one strategic reason or another, making a decision to change up a manufacturing site or to make some modifications, minor modifications to the formulations themselves.
Now, I know that we've already talked about how this could be theoretically applied in personalized medicine as an approach. To me, it sounds like it's still eons away. So I'd like to ask you both, what do you expect for this field to happen in the next 5 years or in the next 10 years, let's say?
So John talked a lot about what we can learn from the software and in terms of personalized medicine. But we also have a lot of gains to make in terms of being able to produce a drug product or a dosage form that's able to meet those demands. So John had mentioned maybe tailoring the dose to different patients based on their physiologies, et cetera. But also in addition to dose, we can tailor things like the release rate. So we've thought about, can we use a technology, for example, like 3D printing that would allow us to develop, you know, very small quantities of drug products tailored for each individual patient that not only has a tailored dose, but has a tailored release rate, maybe a tailored size, maybe tailored colors for kids. Maybe they pick the color of the tablet that they want to ingest. But with that comes a lot of gains that need to be made in the 3D printing manufacturing process itself. A friend of mine actually has this vision that just as we have printers at home, you know, to print documents, maybe one day we'll have 3D printers in our homes. The doctor puts in a prescription for us for a certain drug dose and release rate, let's say, and then we press a button and we print that medicine ourselves. And of course, that can be scary to think about, but and pretty futuristic, but I think it's also an interesting idea. So I guess we have a long, long way to go. But in the meantime, we are continuing to think about different ways of, as I said, manufacturing and testing those drugs.
Deanna, what you just described totally sounds like the Star Trek replicator to me. This is fantastic.
Well, I was going to say your friend must be the Willy Wonka of pharmacy, Deanna.
Nice.
In a good way. I mean, you know, I say that with all due respect. I mean, Willy Wonka, one of the great visionaries on the candy side. My goodness, could you imagine what you just described?
I can't. And then, you know, you think about the headaches with things like paper jams, right? So, right? You have a headache. You want this thing now.
If I just offer my quick thoughts here, Martina, the FDA is very interested in building up the models for the non-oral delivery pathways. So we've got partnerships in place with them to build up the same sort of systems for delivery through the skin, inhaled into the lungs, injected into the muscle or subcutaneous space, dosed through the eye. 5 years from now, I'm hoping that we will be at the same level of confidence with these delivery routes as we are today with the oral pathways. And I'm confident we'll get there. And then something that I get is very boring, but is necessary, and that is the understanding and the education for the next generation of scientists. I would just say that the field is evolving very rapidly, and those who spend the time to learn are going to become the next generation of managers and thought leaders within their organization. There is no career development path that I could recommend more than becoming an expert in modeling and simulation.
And I think this is a fantastic way to end the podcast. Thank you both for your time. It was really nice having you here, and I learned a lot. So I hope that our listeners have as well.
Great. Thank you very much, Martina. Thank you, Deanna. Thank you, listeners.
Indeed, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to A View on Drug Bioavailability Enhancement with Lonza's Deanna Mudi and John DiBella from Simulations Plus. We will be back soon with another deep dive into the pharma manufacturing world, and our next episode will close our third season officially. If you cannot wait, head over to lonza.com/a-view-on to listen to our previous episodes and access additional materials and interviewee info. You can also subscribe to the podcast to never miss an episode and get access to our previous episodes. Thank you, and bye for now.